From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a Supreme Court nominee. Big wins for Clinton and Trump. John Kerry says genocide. President Obama nominated Judge Merrick Garland to fill the vacancy on the Supreme Court. He spoke in the Rose Garden Wednesday with a challenge.
I have fulfilled my constitutional duty. Now it's time for the Senate to do theirs.
Hillary Clinton swept Tuesday's Democratic primaries. In Florida Tuesday night, she seemed to turn her sights on Donald Trump.
Our commander-in-chief has to be able to defend our country, not embarrass it.
But Trump won big, too. He told CNN there will be big trouble if he's denied the nomination in a contested convention.
We're way ahead of everybody. I don't think you can say that we don't get it automatically. I think you'd have riots.
I think you'd have riots. This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with J. Newton Small of Time, Ben Domenech of The Federalist, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you think Congress should do about the Supreme Court? What do you make of the primaries where they're rolling? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from Washington is J. Newton Small, Washington correspondent for Time, Time Magazine, author of Broad Influence, How Women Are Changing the Way America Works. Jay, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Great to talk to you.
Also from Washington, Ben Domenech, co-founder, publisher of the web magazine The Federalist, host of the Federalist Radio Hour, fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Ben Domenech, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Jay, and Ben.
All right. Here we have the nominee. We all saw that ceremony in the Rose Garden. It was moving. You couldn't help but be moved by the emotion of the new nominee, Merrick Garland. And there are big arguments being made here. Jay, is there a path to hearings here? I'm reading headlines in your newspaper saying Democrats plan push to force, I mean, in the Washington Post, I should say, to plan to force hearings on the Supreme Court nomination. How would they do that?
Well, there is certainly a very concerted effort by Democrats to force hearings. They're going state by state, where there's seven Senate seats that are held by the Republicans right now that Obama won either in 2008 or 2012. And those are vulnerable seats. Five of them are already toss-ups. And so you see the Democrats organizing in those states to try to force Republicans, particularly vulnerable Republicans, to at least allow for a hearing. And it's going to be a long and ugly fight. And Republicans are already sort of digging in, saying this is evidence that they're politicizing the nomination, that it was always meant to be all about the campaign and not actually about who the nominee is or what the court is about. And basically the Democratic push is just pushing Republicans to dig in their heels even more to say, no, we're not going to even consider talking about this nominee. And then you have poor Merrick Garland, who is an eminently qualified guy who basically has become almost immediately a pinata, and it has nothing to do with his qualifications and everything to do with just the politics of the day.
Ben, the Republicans do not want to lose their Senate majority. Do you see that as potentially threatened by the political uproar over the Supreme Court nominee?
Not at all, Tom. And the real reason is that there's just so much more going on with this election that distracts people away from any conversation about this nominee. The other issue with Merrick Garland is he's kind of being put forward by President Obama as a challenge to Republicans in the sense that you can nominate this older, moderate nominee, or you could wait for a potential Hillary Clinton nominee who could be much younger, much more liberal. The irony of that situation, though, is that he's put forward a nominee who is, if he's weak on anything when it comes to a particular issue. On the left, he's considered generally pro-cop, generally not going along with the criminal justice reform movement that we've seen of late, which is of a lot of importance to younger liberals. And then on the right, if he's weak on anything, he's weakest on the gun issue, where he's viewed as being on the opposite side of the Heller decision and other decisions. That makes it very easy for Republican senators to just say a flat no, we're not interested in even considering this nominee, because that's not something that they view as being all that damaging to their electoral
prospects.
So
you don't buy, I mean, people have described Mitch McConnell as sweating bullets about this hanging onto his majority. He likes that majority.
He does like that majority, but I don't think that he views Merrick Garland as being someone who actually puts that majority in question. I think he's a lot more concerned about the potential down ballot ramifications of a Trump nomination.
We'll get to that. Here was the president in the Rose Garden saying, look, you got to do this or the whole process for sustaining our Supreme Court, nominating, confirming will be broken.
I simply ask Republicans in the Senate to give him a fair hearing and then an up or down vote. If you don't, then it will not only be an abdication of the Senate's constitutional duty, it will indicate a process for nominating and confirming judges that is beyond repair.
And Mitch McConnell, minutes after the president spoke, we've got our jobs.
It is the president's constitutional right to nominate a Supreme Court justice, and it is the Senate's constitutional right to act as a check on a president and withhold its consent.
Jack Beatty, this is an extraordinary situation that has emerged here. Potentially no ninth Supreme Court justice for more than a year. Now, people are making a lot of claims, but from everything I've seen, that is without precedent, significantly without precedent, that amount of time. What do you think of this standoff, Jack?
Well, you know, you have to ask the question the president asked. Why not give him a hearing? Well, here's a conjecture. Hearings would expose, really, what the senators want on the court, and that is a justice like the late Antonin Scalia, who believes in the dead Constitution, a document, to paraphrase William Buckley, that stands athwart history and yells no to social, cultural, and environmental change. By contrast, the dead Constitution freezes social and economic arrangements right where they are and yells yes to corporate power over politics and labor. I mean, the conservative pressure groups won't let senators hear Judge Garland lest the public overhear the voice of conservatism whispering yes to the status quo.
Watch out. Not even a hearing. Merrick Garland himself praised and praised for years by people on all sides, making that very sort of moderate sort of appeal as he stood in the Rose Garden on Wednesday.
He or she must be faithful to the Constitution and to the statutes passed by the Congress. He or she must put aside his personal views or preferences and follow the law, not make it.
And a few Republican senators saying, well, wait a minute, maybe I'll sit down with this guy. That's not hearings. But here was Susan Collins, Republican senator of Maine, saying she disagrees with colleagues planning to deny a hearing to President Obama's Supreme Court nominee.
I believe that the best outcomes in the Senate, whether we're dealing with nominees or treaties or legislation, come about when we follow the regular order.
Jay, do you agree with Ben that Mitch McConnell won't really feel a sufficient threat to bend on this to his Senate majority?
I would say in the current moment, I agree with Ben. I think that if you see some of his vulnerable members start to feel uncomfortable about the nomination, if it starts to play into their races and they start to say, call on, you know, the Senate majority leader to have hearings, then his mind might change. But that remains to be seen. And like Ben said, there are a lot other factors in this race that are playing more heavily in these races, like the potential nomination of Donald Trump, which has those sort of down ballot Republicans a lot more worried than what might happen with their constituents over outrage of whether Merrick Garland gets a hearing or not. I think most Americans are not really paying a huge amount of attention to this. They kind of know it's happening, but it's certainly not an issue that impacts their economy, for example, or their work or their wages or anything else like that. They don't feel the pinch of the Supreme Court, per se. So it remains to be seen is the answer.
It is amazing how many issues can be overshadowed, shunted aside by Trump fever. We've got callers on. It is just amazing. Santa Fe, New Mexico. Chris is calling. Chris, wonderful to have you. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My issue and concern is I'm being deprived of my third leg of government by the GOP's stance on refusing to hold a hearing. I'm entitled to a full Supreme Court, and they have pretty much drawn a political line through this saying we're not going to do this. It concerns me deeply.
I understand that, Chris. Let me take it to Ben. Here you are. You're from the Federalist. I mean, you're kind of an originalist. As a conservative, do you feel that this is breaking faith? Chris is in New Mexico thinking, wait a minute, I'm entitled to a Supreme Court. What's going on here? Third branch?
I don't think so at all. And I would point to the precedent established by Joe Biden, by Chuck Schumer, and by President Obama.
By what
himself,
Joe Biden said, not what he did. That's
I would argue it's
what
they would
have. Did he deny somebody hearings?
I believe he would have done exactly what he said, which is to not stand up and appoint, and just as Chuck Schumer said in 2007, not that he would not appoint or not move forward with any nominee that the president put forward.
I'm just
in the last
quibbling
year
over the
term.
Word precedent, but what about her appeal to your conservatism
think,
in a way?
Because I don't think that actually is the way that that things work in the normal judicial process now. This is the president's point.
This is broken now.
Yes, but who broke it? I mean, wasn't it the actions of President Obama himself?
Who else was denied a hearing?
I mean, this is the thing.
Anybody?
You have to basically take them at the idea that they were being false when they said that they would not move forward with any nominee who was put forward in that time. And I'm taking them as being honest.
But who else denied a hearing?
Well, but I don't think that that's necessarily the precedent here. In fact, when it comes to the hearing process, I think it's almost more insulting to give Merrick Garland a hearing because that pretends as if they're taking the nomination seriously.
Why shouldn't they take it seriously? It's a nominee of the President of the United States to the Supreme Court.
Nominee,
this is the constitutional process.
Because it's a nominee in the last year of the second term of a president before
so what?
He leaves office, which is traditionally a period of time in which the Senate has not moved forward with these types of nominations very rapidly.
That's not
They
true.
Have stalled. No, no, they really
go back
have.
To George and, Washington.
Yes, but I think in this case, what we have to recognize is that the judicial nomination process has been broken. It's been broken for some time, and it's been broken primarily by those who have been willing to filibuster and block nominees over and over again, which include the President of the United States.
There's no question there have been major, major battles over the high court. I guess the question here is full denial of even a hearing the road we want to go down? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're looking at a week in the news, a Supreme Court nominee. Big week for Trump and Clinton. John Kerry on ISIS. He says it's genocide. And an American student gets 15 years hard labor in North Korea. J. Newton Small is with us, Washington correspondent for Time, author of Broad Influence. Ben Domenech is here. He's co-founder and publisher of the web magazine The Federalist. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. What are you thinking on Merrick Garland and his nomination, the resistance to hearings on that? Does it look like it's going to be Trump versus Clinton to you in the general election in November? Can you live with that? Republican kingpins are trying to derail Trump. Will there be, as Trump warns, riots if they do? A lot of politics to get to, but we've got a lot of callers on the Supreme Court. Nick in Clawson, Michigan. Nick, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I just want to say that Mr. McConnell stood up and said that the voice of the people should be heard in this nomination. And the fact is that the voice of the people was heard in this nomination by electing President Obama twice. For him to stand up and say that they have the right not to consider a nominee is just as ridiculous as if after the next president is elected that the Democratic members of Congress would stand up and say, well, we don't think this president should elect a nominee for the Supreme Court. They wouldn't hold.
Pretty soon you're frozen forever. Nobody wants to. Everybody wants to wait for the people to speak again or again.
Yes.
Nick, we've got it. Let me get one more, and I'll bring it to you, Jack. Shirley in Sterling, Massachusetts. Shirley, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I heard the speaker from the New York from the Times say that she didn't think that the electorate was really paying attention to the nomination for Supreme Court Justice Garland. I think that's not true. I know a lot of people are really paying attention very closely, and it troubles me considerably that we've moved away from the rule of law as much as we have. I'd like to see a return to the rule of law as quickly as possible.
I mean, but of course, people on all sides, if they're paying attention, will be paying attention. Merrick Garland might be open to stricter oversight of guns. May not favor the view that the individual gun ownership is a right guaranteed by the Second Amendment. And can you see, Shirley, why those on the right might say, whoa, no, 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 don't do this. We want another election, maybe get a Republican in there before we shift the Scalia balance.
I agree that they may have that position, and that's fine. I actually don't really mind them having positions differ from my own, but I do want them to hold a hearing. I think that's their job.
Shirley, I appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, there have been hammer and tong fights, as you and everybody well know, over the Supreme Court for a long time. Is this tactic fundamentally different, or is this just part of what Ben Domenech describes as the ongoing brokenness of how we're nominating and confirming judges?
Well, it seems different to me. I mean, Ben talks about what Joe Biden said. Let's look at what Joe Biden did. When he was chairman of the Judiciary Committee in 1988, the Judiciary Committee, that was the last year of the Reagan administration, the Democrats controlled the Senate. It was an analogous moment to this. The committee held hearings on Justice Kennedy, and he was confirmed had a vote and was confirmed by the whole Senate. So there's an analogy. Since 1988, we seem to have gone down. That's what Joe Biden did then, and now we're doing something else.
Could it be, Jay, that Mitch McConnell will watch the polls, and if it appears that a Democratic nominee to the presidency looks more likely to win in the general election, that he might want to go ahead and have those hearings before, let's say, if Hillary Clinton were to win, and she could decide to bring in someone more liberal?
Absolutely. And I've heard, you know, Senator Orrin Hatch, who is a senior Republican on the committee from Utah, said publicly that he thought that maybe not have hearings before the election. He didn't think there'd be any movement before the election, but he thought there was every possibility that Merrick Garland could be confirmed in lame duck session. So lame duck is obviously the session that happens after the election. It's usually 3 or 4 weeks in November into December before the new session begins in January. And if Republicans say lose either or both the White House and the Senate, and they're looking at, you know, Hillary Clinton potentially nominating somebody who's more liberal versus Merrick Garland, they might rush to hold a confirmation hearing and confirm Merrick Garland in that period.
Could President Obama in that period after a November election withdraw Merrick Garland at that point, say, well, we've got a new president now elected, and I want to give, let's say, Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders, I want to give them, now that we're this close to the handover of power, the opportunity to nominate a justice.
Theoretically, he absolutely could withdraw Merrick Garland at any time in this process. Mm-hmm. But I've heard from Senate Democrats that they do expect a lame duck run for Merrick Garland if Hillary Clinton wins the White House or if Mitch McConnell loses the Senate, and that they do expect that this is his best path towards confirmation. So I think both sides in the Senate are seeing this as a potential path to get Garland onto the court.
We have to turn to politics. Big wins this week for Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. The latest that Missouri is in his corner as well. So really running the table this week. And it was a big week for Republican delegates. Donald Trump saying, you know, looks likely that I'll be close, or if I am close and somebody else is pretty far behind me in a delegate count, there would be riots if I don't get the nomination. But plenty of Republicans still working on other plans. Here was House Speaker Paul Ryan talking with reporters just yesterday, saying that the chances of an open or contested GOP convention are seeming more likely.
Nothing's changed other than the perception that this is more likely to become an open convention than we thought before. So we're getting our minds around the idea that this could very well become a reality.
Ben Domenech, is that what is shaping up here? What paths do you see now on the horizon?
I think it's very likely that Donald Trump will go into the convention in Cleveland with a plurality of delegates, but it's somewhat less likely that he's going to get enough to actually clinch the nomination. The interesting thing is that there's a lot of precedent for a candidate getting a plurality of delegates and then going to a convention and not actually getting the nomination. It's happened a number of times in history. And of the six Republican presidents who came out of contested conventions, there is that kind of precedent for a debate to happen. In fact, it may be just what the GOP needs, given given how fractious this primary has been, to have some kind of process play out in that manner. Of course, Donald Trump, because he does not like rules generally, is currently whining about them and is complaining about them and threatening the possibility of riots if he does not get the nomination. I think that that's something that he is, to a degree, there playing with a good bit of fire. If you see riots at the Cleveland Convention from Trump supporters, I think that they'll find in pretty short order what the party of law and order is all about, and I think that they'll be shut down pretty quickly. The much better process that needs to play out over the course of the next couple of weeks and months really is the Republicans really coming to grips with whether they are okay with Donald Trump as their nominee. There's an opportunity for them to prevent him from getting that to that 1237 number to rally around Ted Cruz to a degree, but he is so toxic to the leadership of the Republican Party that they've been very reluctant to do so. You saw Mitch McConnell this week just asking for an apology to try to mend fences, which is not the sort of thing that I think is going to be forthcoming from Mr. Cruz.
Shut down pretty quickly, you say. The Law and Order Party. Are you threatening billy clubs against your fellow Republicans? Are you?
I think that Trump supporters would find that that when it comes to conventions, security forces are pretty quick to respond to any threats of violence when there are a lot of politicians around. And Donald Trump, I think, has been fomenting a good deal of violence. He's been doing it in, I think, a consistent way, particularly his comment about paying for the legal fees of those who punch other people at his rallies. And it's that kind of rhetoric that I think is going to ultimately prevent him from being the kind of uniter he claims to be.
Boy, we had Curly Hoagland, this is the North Dakotan, who's on the Republican National Committee Rules Committee, saying, telling CNBC this week that the nomination process is... it's the party, not the voters, that choose the nominees. That attitude that, hey, you vote like you as you will, but it's the party that makes the rules and chooses the nominee, that is out there. That is in action. On the other hand, it's not just Donald Trump. I mean, you say whining, but threatening riots, it's a little more than whining, I guess. And even Ted Cruz, here he was talking with reporters on Sunday, said a brokered convention would enrage a lot of people.
There are an awful lot of folks in Washington, the Washington establishment, that have these fevered dreams of a brokered convention. These fevered dreams of the convention deadlocking and their being able to parachute in their favorite establishment candidate. That would be an absolute disaster. The people would quite rightly revolt.
Revolt. Is that the same as riot this year? I'm not sure. Revolution, riot, lots of words in the air we don't normally anticipate. J. Newton Small, what about this path and the Republican Party readiness to challenge Donald Trump with a contested convention?
I mean, most Republicans that I've spoken to, including the staff at Paul Ryan's office, have said that it is a disastrous recipe because let's say you do have a brokered convention. I mean, first of all, let's forget about a contested convention because, as Lindsey Graham said to me on Monday, if you really want to destroy the Republican Party, parachute in somebody at the 11th hour who didn't actually have his hat in the ring, didn't actually try to get any votes, and then anoint that person your nominee.
Remind us of how you're defining these two things that would mean a parachute, broker versus contest.
Sure. So a brokered convention is you pick amongst the candidates who ran for president, right, who were on the ballots and who actually tried to be the nominee. A contested convention is you change the rules, which you would have to do in the beginning of the convention. It's the 112-person rules committee that comes in, which is basically appointed at the first day of the convention.
Yep.
And they would then change the rules to say that the only people that – instead of saying the only people we will consider are those who are on the ballot, to say we will consider after the first – if there is not a nominee after the first ballot, we'll consider other names in contention. And then you see somebody like Mitt Romney coming in or Paul Ryan or someone else. And so that's the difference between a brokered convention, which is choosing amongst the pool of candidates who've already run, and a contested convention where you're choosing amongst any old Republican. It can be anybody, really. But basically the idea that you would have a contested convention where you would have somebody else come in, that's pretty much ruled off the table. I mean, almost everybody that I've spoken into the party says that would just be disastrous. But
there's plenty of talk about that. But you say Paul Ryan's people say it would be disastrous, but here we just heard him saying we're getting our minds around the idea that this could very well become a reality.
Well, I mean, but he says that and then, you know, pretty
That's
much
yesterday.
Yeah, I know, but they also say that even though that is the reality, that's looking more and more likely, it's not good for the party. I mean, you then, if you have a brokered convention and Donald Trump does not get it, you have the potential of riots, as Donald Trump says, but then you also have, you're going to take at least a month after the convention to unify a party that will be in complete turmoil. And so that's a month that you're missing campaigning against Hillary Clinton, who essentially already is the Democratic nominee now. So she has a huge advantage of time and fundraising and, you know, and making your case with the American people, while the Republicans would just continue on with this chaos. It would completely hobble their general election, and it would be disastrous.
Jack Beatty, there's been talk lately about how Democrats rejected George Wallace and his racist campaign back in the day, and even Republicans saying now it's time for Republicans to step up and do their job, do the same with Donald Trump. But you've got a lot of voters who have checked that box, the Trump box, Jack.
You have, and they would be repudiated by the Republican Party. You know, Trump is right. He says, this is a political phenomenon, my movement. I have drawn in people to the Republican Party who haven't voted for it before. I think the data confirms that. Voters, white voters, either moved by his white nationalism or his protectionism or his anti-immigrant, whatever it is, they are coming in, and they do form a kind of movement. And to come in, have a kind of smoke-filled room, decide that he will not be the nominee, I think that would be poison for the Republican Party going ahead. But on the other hand, nominating such a candidate with 60% disapproval, of course, he'd be running against a candidate in Hillary Clinton with 50% disapproval, but nevertheless, nominating someone with that incubus around his neck is almost certain to lose in November.
William, there's one to remember. William in Dayton, Ohio. You're on the air, William. Thanks for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
I voted for John Kasich in our local primary here.
Yep.
And I think Bernie Sanders' campaign is going down, and Donald Trump should take the opportunity to come out, support Garrett behind Obama to help repair our political system, and he could take some of Bernie's independent voters who are unsure.
You think you want Donald Trump to repair our political system? Is that what you said, William?
Well, I think if he were to come out and support President Obama's nomination and start to make these deals before, show that he can lead the Republican Party without even being in charge, I believe that he could take some of the independent voters from Bernie Sanders before they just go with Hillary. And I think, I don't know, it's a unique perspective, and I think he has an opportunity to do that.
No, it's very interesting. I mean, you say Sanders going down. Sanders himself doesn't think so. Here he was in Phoenix, Arizona this week.
Next week, Arizona has a very important election. We will win. We will win if the voter turnout is high. Let's make it high. Thank you all very much.
Passion, the burn, still there, but the delegate count's looking rough. And, of course, John Kasich, big thrill of the week. He took his Ohio, and he took it pretty strongly. Here he was going all the way, well, to Cleveland.
We are going to go all the way to Cleveland and secure the Republican nomination.
Ben, if this does get, mixed up at the convention, who's the one who comes in against Trump? Who else might the party choose? Are they going to go for Cruz despite all the disenchantment with him over the years in Washington? Could John Kasich actually be handed the nomination?
I don't think so, and I think that really Cruz is their only alternative at this point. He's going to come in with the second most delegates. He's going to be the only other candidate who's going to come in there with an 8-state win, which is what you need to get by the Rule 40. They'd have to change that rule in order to bring John Kasich forward. And I think that in addition to that, you're going to see over the coming weeks a number of Republicans stand up and support Cruz, as we've seen a lot of them who've previously supported Rubio or had other candidates in the race now throwing their hat in with him, even reluctantly, even people like Lindsey Graham, who have the worst kind of positive relationship with him, supporting him this week. In addition to that, I think that to the caller's point, Donald Trump's problem is actually not going to be bringing in Bernie supporters or that kind of youthful energy. His problem is on his right flank, which is as much of a flight risk from the Republican Party as any of them at this point. This faction of never Trump folks, which is mostly made up of church-going evangelicals who find Trump more distasteful than perhaps the more secular parts of the party, they've been the ones who've been the most reluctant to support Trump and are most in that faction of saying that they would not come out and support him. We saw the poll data from Ohio and Florida where you had significant portions of the Republican electorate saying that they would look third party. I think that's his real problem going forward.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace, the simplest way to create a beautiful website. Whether your passion is bold, unconventional, or just plain crazy, you should share it with the world in an unforgettable way. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. And enter offer code ONPOINT at checkout to get 10% off your first purchase.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, SeaWorld says it is ending its orca breeding program. No more baby Shamu in captivity. SeaWorld CEO Joel Manby.
Society is changing. And if you look at people's general comfort level with orcas under human care, I've seen a real shift in society.
American student Otto Warmbier was sentenced to 15 years hard labor in North Korea for taking a propaganda poster from a hotel wall. He begged for mercy when his sentence came down on Wednesday.
My brother and my sister need me. I beg that you see how I am only human. How I have made the worst mistake of my life.
Good luck to him, poor kid. And creator of the Broadway mega hit Hamilton, Lin-Manuel Miranda, freestyled in the Rose Garden with cue cards from President Obama. The president held up immigrants, POTUS, Oval Office.
And immigrants, we get the job done. This is so fun. POTUS is holding up the signs. I'm not done. It's the Oval Office. Oh, my gosh, I can't believe I'm there. It's so much more intimidating than if it was square. Opportunity knocks, and I can't.
We're looking at a week in the news. Supreme Court nominee, big week for Trump and Clinton. Kerry on ISIS. He says genocide there. That American student in North Korea, J. Newton Small, is with us. Washington correspondent for Time, Ben Dominitz from The Federalist. Jack Beatty is here. You can join us on the election, on what, American foreign policy, where that's going to go. We've got all kinds of things going on with North Korea right now. What are you thinking on the Flint water testimony, the NFL and head trauma, the American ISIS guy who tried to get out, surrendered there, is out, I guess. Are your March Madness brackets busted already? Steve in Jefferson City, Missouri. Steve, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hello. I wonder why the media is making such a fuss over John Kasich's win in Ohio when, first of all, he was a popular governor, but it was an open primary, and Democrats in droves came over to vote for him just to muddy the water. I don't think he's a credible candidate, and I think he's a guaranteed loser if he ever comes out with the nomination.
So what would you do, Steve?
Well, I think that Trump is correct. That there's going to be a lot of difficulty for Republicans if he wins the plurality of the votes and is denied the nomination. He wasn't my candidate, but I don't see how they can have a brokered convention without risking a sure thing that there'll be a third party candidate if they don't let the people speak. The party bigwigs can't just come in here and determine who the candidate's going to be.
Steve, we've got it, and I appreciate your call from Missouri there. And, of course, the news just in from Missouri this morning that Hillary Clinton has beaten Bernie Sanders there in that state. It took a long time to get those vote counts. They were both in both parties. Those were close results there. She clearly feeling her oats this week and turning more of her fire on Donald Trump himself. Talked with Arizona station KTAR earlier today, and she was asked what she thinks about securing the border, Donald Trump and his wall maybe, between the U.S. and Mexico.
I think we've done a really good job securing the border, and I think that those who say we haven't are not paying attention to everything that was done for the last 15 years.
Jay Newton Small, there's Hillary Clinton today going right at the sort of first brick in the wall of Donald Trump, the wall with Mexico. If it's Trump v. Clinton, how does that race look to you, Jay?
You know, Donald Trump has upended every expectation, and so it's really tough to predict. And certainly the Clinton campaign has said repeatedly that they worry about him because he has the potential to redraw the map in ways that, say, Ted Cruz wouldn't. I mean, Ted Cruz would run in traditional Republican states, and the electorate would look very similar to as it looked in 2008 and 2012, whereas Donald Trump, maybe he puts Pennsylvania into play, which is more of a blue state. Maybe he puts Wisconsin or Oregon into play. You have no idea. Despite the sort of unpredictability of Donald Trump, by the numbers, I just don't see how he could possibly win a general election. I mean, not only is he underwater with Latinos and with African Americans, but with women, for example. There hasn't been a Republican who has won the White House, won women for in a presidential race since Ronald Reagan. In fact, the only two Republicans who've won the White House since have been the two Bushes, and they've done it by mitigating the loss of women to Democrats by to less than 5 percentage points. And Donald Trump, overall with women, is underwater by 45 percentage points at this point. And that's just one of several demographics where he's a lot of issues. And so it's hard to imagine how he builds a general election coalition, frankly.
Ben Domenech, how about it? If it's Trump v. Clinton, what do you foresee?
I think that Donald Trump is a negotiator, and he negotiates from the extremes. He's been negotiating to this point with the electorate of the Republican Party in the context of the primary, and with the disaffected working class voters who've crossed over to support him. Once he starts negotiating with a general electorate, I think that you would see him shift on a number of issues, as he's already kind of started to speak in those terms. I don't think it's out of the question that Donald Trump ends up running a competitive campaign. And perhaps even beating Hillary Clinton. It still seems unlikely for the reasons that Jay cited, but it's just not the sort of thing that you can predict in a cycle in which so many of the expectations that you normally believe about the way things work have been upended by his presence and by how much he's had an impact, not just on the Republican Party, but on our entire political conversation.
Matt in Atlanta, Georgia. Matt, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Great topic. I just want to mention that if there is a brokered convention and the Republicans essentially take the nomination away from Donald Trump, I think there will be riots in the streets. We've already seen the Democrats trying to steal the election from Bernie Sanders with the superdelegate process, and it totally goes against everything our democracy stands for. I think that if this happens with Trump, you're going to see a large number of Republican supporters leave the party and go independent. And Republican supporters are already disgusted with the party for not holding up their ideals throughout the last few years.
So, Matt, you're a Trump guy, Matt. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that is correct.
And what do you think about, this week he was asked about who would be on his foreign policy team, and he basically said me, myself, and I. He'll come out with other names, but listen to this clip with us for a second here, Matt. I want to get your response to it. You're a Trump supporter. This was on NBC's Morning Joe Wednesday, and Trump was asked who he consults about foreign policy.
I'm speaking with myself, number one, because I have a very good brain, and I've said a lot of things.
Okay, he said more than that, but that was really the heart of it. Matt, are you comfortable with that? I mean, Donald Trump's creative and energetic, but has he got the right sort of cut to really be president, where you've got to consult with people? You've got to have a team with you.
Sometimes I feel like he doesn't want to give the media too much fodder to chew on. He may or may not have a set of advisors in place right now, but I have total confidence that by the time the election rolls around that he will. We've seen how dishonest the media has been throughout this whole political process.
I don't know what you mean by that, Matt. I don't know what you mean by that.
Well, about
I'm the media. I'm not dishonest. I don't know what you're saying.
Well, I have seen the media be particularly dishonest when talking about Donald Trump and reporting on a lot of his campaign. They say a lot of things about him being racist and a bigot, and I just don't see that at all. I mean, I didn't really call to debate this, although I can if you've got time. I mean, we can go into
No, we got more to look at, but I think people can look at what Trump has said and draw their conclusions, and some media have. But Matt, let's clip it there. I think we got it. You have confidence in his ability to maneuver and to negotiate, and you're with him. One more right here, Serge in Detroit. Serge, you're on. Hello, Serge. Are you there, my friend?
Yeah, I'm just want to talk about the fact that the media, I'm sorry, the fact that the media is portraying this race, the Democratic Party, as already won by Hillary Clinton, but these superdelegates have yet to vote until July. In 2008, Obama was faced with the same issue, and he ended up getting, excuse me, by popular vote, ended up getting all these delegate votes that we've already given to Hillary Clinton.
So you think Bernie could pull those superdelegates over and still have a run at this? Jay Newton Small, how about it? Serge, thanks for your call. Jay?
Well, to just clarify, in 2008, Barack Obama, after pretty much New Hampshire and Super Tuesday took a delegate lead that Hillary pretty much never overcame. In the Democratic race, almost every state does their delegates by proportion. So if you win whatever proportion of the vote you win, you split the delegates that way. Whereas in the Republican race, after March 15th, it becomes winner take all. It is very difficult, if not impossible, to overcome a pledged delegate lead once you've built a pretty big one, and Hillary's is well over 300. Now, in the 2008 race, it was opposite. Hillary had, Barack Obama had a significant pledged delegate lead. Hillary was behind. She was arguing that the superdelegates should come her way, or that they should sway the nomination. And there was a lot of pushback from the Democratic Party to say, no, the superdelegates should not overturn the will of the people. I think this time around, you'll see this something similar. And then it also is a fact that Hillary has almost all the superdelegate support as already tied up. So she sort of already has the insurmountable pledged delegate lead as well as all the superdelegates supporting her. So it makes it very difficult. I mean, Bernie Sanders has a very, very, very narrow path. It would take essentially total catastrophe on the Hillary Clinton side in order for him to become the nominee at this point.
His supporters still watching that very closely. Thinking about Donald Trump on foreign policy, lots going on that front this week. You got North Korea with ballistic missiles flying some considerable distance, as we've got big war games that are going on there, or exercises with the South Korean and U.S. military forces. You've got John Kerry saying genocide in ISIS. That has international law implications. I don't know how that will play out, but here he was on Thursday in Washington.
My purpose in appearing before you today is to assert that in my judgment, Daesh is responsible for genocide against groups in areas under its control, including Yazidis, Christians, and Shia Muslims.
1948 UN Convention on Genocide requires signatories, including the United States, to work to prevent genocide, punish perpetrators when it does occur. We'll see what follows out of that. And, Russia pulling out of Syria this week, sort of. I mean, still got bases there, but a bunch went home. But Vladimir Putin saying just yesterday at the Kremlin, they could be right back there in a jiffy if they needed to be.
If it will be required, Russia is capable of increasing its grouping in the region to the size that will be adequate to the situation in view. And we will use the whole range of the capacities that we will have at our disposal.
And that's just from a couple of days. Ben Domenech, if it were President Trump guiding American foreign policy, and he says his consultants are between his ears, what do you think?
You know, the interesting thing about Donald Trump, and we saw the exit of Marco Rubio this week, who was kind of the vehicle, as Ross Douthat wrote in the New York Times, for a resurgence of Bushism, a George W. Bush policy repackaged in a new form. Donald Trump is a rejection of that in virtually every sense, including on the foreign policy side of things, where he's sounded both a more aggressive sense in terms of bombing our enemies, and also a more restrained sense when it comes to intervening around the world, something that's allowed him to appeal to a lot of people who believed that the neoconservative agenda that we saw under the past President Bush was not something that was wisely chosen. Who knows who his advisors would be? It's impossible to say what Trump would do within that context, because we've never seen him in that format and he has no experience with it. As he likes to say, he does watch a lot of the shows, however, and he does have a good brain. But I think to your caller's point earlier, he has faith in Trump as being someone who will ultimately make the right decision. And that's so much of what's animating his support. It's not about ideology. It's not about policies. It's not about a set of approaches to how you would run government. It's simply faith in Donald Trump as an individual that he will fight for you and for your interests.
It's very unusual. Jack.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, the mercurial vacancy of Trump's mind, that actually may be preferable to the advice that Ted Cruz gets on foreign policy from, say, Frank Gaffney, an Islamophobe lunatic who sees an agent of the Muslim Brotherhood where reality discloses Grover Norquist. This guy's one of Cruz's advisors.
Yeah, Cruz has got his list out there, and Jack, we hear you're not going for him. This could get stranger. We've got this police FBI investigating a letter apparently sent to Trump's apartment in or his son's apartment in New York. His son Eric, white powder letter postmarked March 5th from Boston, where we're sitting right here, saying if your father doesn't get out of the race, the next envelope won't be a fake. That stinks. That's lousy in all circumstances. But what strange territory we're in. Rough hearings in Washington this week on the whole Flint water mess. Got very heated yesterday as EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy and the governor of Michigan, Rick Snyder, were testifying there on lead contamination. Here's an exchange between the EPA chief and Republican Rep. Jason Chaffetz.
You have to look at how the law works, and we did.
Yeah, you know what? And it failed. You failed. You said, quote, if there is anything I could do, if there was any switch I could pull, you had that under the law, and you didn't do it.
No, sir, I did not have that under the law.
Yes, you did.
Well, Jay, we've got a big Republican there saying, why wasn't the federal government more into this? That's not the usual message from conservative
from
Republicans.
Chaffetz.
Jason Chaffetz, yeah.
Exactly. That was striking to me, and particularly taking on Rick Snyder, who's a Republican governor of Michigan, and really holding his feet to the fire and saying, you failed your people here. It was surprising, but it has been an incredibly embarrassing episode, not just for Michigan, but for Republicans in general, for the country, frankly. It's a horrible circumstance to have children exposed to lead poisoning en masse. I mean, it's just terrible.
And the whole subway down in the nation's capital this week, I mean, that's kind of embarrassing too, isn't it? What about maintenance? What about just sort of minimal keeping the infrastructure together, Jay?
Well, I just also wondered, I mean, there are all sorts of great conspiracy theories in Washington that it was, you know, some sort of cloak and dagger CIA, you know, Jack Bauer.
Oh, wait, what was going on down there? What?
Never ascribe something that interesting to the failure of Metro.
Yeah, we were sorry to see that. But, you know, when people talk about infrastructure, jobs, getting the country together, we see opportunity, as a politician might say. Jay Newton Small, Washington correspondent for Time, author of Broad Influence. It's terrific to have you with us, Jay. Come again. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Tom.
Ben Domenech at The Federalist. Same to you, Ben. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Jack, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Listeners, our Week in the News newsletter this week looks back at some of the legal and political posturing around Judge Merrick Garland's nomination. You can hear from his Harvard Law School classmates, constitutional law experts, and more. Sign up for that newsletter, if you will, at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Facebook at On Point Radio, on Twitter at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for being with us today. This is On Point.